racing in Cleveland, Kansas City team.
Welcome back to the memoir edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowain. Back in the 1950s, at the dawn of rock and roll, South Philly was a hotbed of chart-busting teen idols. Among them were Charlie Gracie, Fabian, Frankie Avalon, and our guest, Bobby Rydell. Rydell, with his signature pompadour and boyish good looks, rose to prominence with hits like Wild One and Volare, as well as his appearance in the film Bye Bye Birdie. He wrote about his experiences in his memoir called Bobby Rydell, Teen Idol on the Rocks. He joined us earlier this year, along with the memoir's co-author, Alan Slutsky. Let's take a listen. So what was it about South Philly, 1950s, that was the home of so many of these teen idols?
Well, I always used to say that there was a water trough.
You think so?
Yes, on 9th and Dickinson. And if you drank out of it, you became a singer. If you put your feet in it, you became a dancer. If you did both, you were a song and dance man. I don't know why.
But it is interesting, Alan. Why do you think this part of Philly just gave rise to so many of these stars of the 50s and 60s?
Well, first of all, you know, they were a bunch of good-looking kids. I mean, Avalon was, you know, devilishly handsome. Bobby was, you see the cover of the book, Bobby was a killer. Like, whenever I showed a book cover to anybody, they go, oh, my God.
Handsome guy, right?
He was a handsome guy.
You look at that picture on the book and you go, what happened?
We all do that, just so you know.
What happened?
You write about your dad, I guess, buying you your first drum. You had gone to see Gene Krupa play.
My dad was a big band lover, and years ago we had a place in Center City called the Earl Theater. And my dad took me one afternoon to see Benny Goodman and his orchestra, and who was playing drums for Benny Goodman but Gene Krupa. Mm-hmm. And I said to my father, I don't know who that guy is, Daddy, but I want to be him. I want to be that guy playing drums. And I started playing when I was about 5, 6 years old and still play today.
And you still do?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And something you were good at? Were you good at? Did it come naturally, or were you one of those kids
No, really, it came naturally. And I had a drum teacher on Wharton, 16th and Wharton. His name was Sam D'Amico. God rest his soul, he passed away. And I studied with him when I was about, 12, 13 years old. Took lessons, and he said to me, Bobby, I can't teach you anymore. You know, I've taught you everything that I know. If you want to pursue it, you know, you have to go to New York City, study with a guy by the name of Sam Ulano. And I said, you know what? I want to play, man. You know, I'm through reading, you know, quarter notes and 16th notes and 8th notes. I just want to play. So it's always been in me, yeah.
And were you always a singer? I mean, did you always have a good voice?
Well, when my dad was overseas, of course, my mom.
For the war.
Yeah, for the war. My mom and my dad, you know, kept writing back. And my mom would always say, the baby's always singing, the baby's always singing. And my father wrote back, who knows, maybe one day we'll have a star in the family.
What?
And I still have that letter today, you know, in my home, yeah.
Alan, what do you hear in Bobby Rydell's voice?
Well, Bobby, he had a lot of influences, particularly Sinatra, guys like, you know, Tony Bennett, Johnny Ray, who he heard when he was a young kid. And he was, of all the South Philly singers, you know, the teen idol guys, it's undisputed. I mean, they all knew he was the voice. You know, it's not something... They're not competitive about it. They just acknowledge Bobby was the singer. You know, some like Fabian was the best looking of the three, but Bobby, you know, Bobby had the pipes.
It's funny.
Go ahead, Bob.
You mentioned Fabe, and he has a blurb in the book, and I think he says something to the effect. He said, "I tried to sing like Bobby Rydell once, and I was in traction for 2 weeks."
That's right.
Because, and at some point, you did have some trouble with your voice. You sort of had learned to sing wrong, as you write about in this book.
Oh,
you had it caught up with you at some
point. Yeah, it didn't do all that much harm, but I was singing on my throat rather than, you know, through the diaphragm. And I studied here in Philadelphia with a guy by the name of Artie Singer, who was a vocal coach. And then years later, in New York City, I studied with a man by the name of Marty Lawrence. And he really corrected me. Mm-hmm. I would say I was about 18, 19 years old. Matter of fact, it was when I was at the Copa. And, yeah, and he straightened me out, you know, and I really learned how to sing properly.
I have a confession to make. I was in the Fabian fan club. I was not in the Bobby Rydell fan club.
You know,
I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. he lived a half a block away from me. You know, we were both on 11th Street. I was 2400. He was 2500. But I never knew him until we got into business because, as you know, Marty, in South Philadelphia, each corner is like a different hang.
Yeah,
you know, you
yeah.
have your own friends at this corner who has their friends at that corner. So I never really knew Fabe until we met in the business.
Let's talk a little bit about American Bandstand. I'm looking at you, Alan, just because it was here, obviously, in Philadelphia, just how influential it was for singers, performers like Bobby Rydell, but also I think for young people that said, you know, this was their entree into this very popular music.
Well, it was the greatest marketing tool in the history of records because they were right at 46 and Market at
the arena,
the studio.
Right?
You're right next to the arena. Yeah. And, you know, you could see Killer Kowalski, you know, throw somebody over the top rope, and then you could go see Bobby Rydell next door.
Right.
That's a perfect evening, right?
Yeah, that's right. But he Dick was the fast track to a hit. If Dick liked your record, it was instantly a hit. So Bobby's first couple records for Cameo, he just told him flat out, "Nah, this ain't got it."
No, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then finally, you know, he heard "Kissing Time." He said, "That's a hit."
Right. Yeah.
And he just made it a hit instantly.
Let me play another song, and this is Volare.
Uh-huh.
What's the story behind Volare?
The story behind Volare was I was in New York City with Bernie Lowe, who was the president of Cameo, and we recorded an album. And we never released the album because the bulk of the album we didn't like, but there were three tunes on the album that came off. One was Sway, one was All Black Magic, and one being Volare.
Right.
And I was just coming off a song called Swingin' School, and we needed something. We didn't have anything that, you know, I went into the studio to record, but Bernie went back and listened to the date that we did in New York City at RCA Recording Studio. And he listened to Volare, put the girls on. The girls, we did the whoa, whoa, and yeah, yeah, which was, you know, my sound. You know,
yeah.
it was my sound for years. Put it out, and it became the second million seller.
Well, let's give it a listen. This is Volare, Bobby Rydell's 1960 hit. That's Bobby Rydell singing Volare. And I have to say, here in studio, he was lip-syncing Volare, knowing those words very, very well.
You know, that's funny. When I did a lot of Red Skelton shows, and the tunes that we did were all pre-recorded. And there was the producer, his name was Cecil Barker, who produced the Red Skelton Hour. And he used to call me the king of the lip syncs.
Oh.
Because when we did the show, you had to lip sync to what we had recorded in the studio.
So let's talk about your hair. And you weren't the only one with this pompadour that I certainly remember.
Yeah, that's
back
gone.
In the 50s. I know, it's gone.
It's all gone. Yes.
What happened to it?
That's what I said. What happened? You know, now I carry, I call him Fred.
Oh, is that right?
I put him in a little box and I take him on the road with me. Yes. I wear a hairpiece. Yes, I do. Yes.
But how much work did you have to go through and how much, what, Brill cream did you have to use to get
no,
this?
No. What was the thing? Not Brill cream. What was the, you know, because I had a lot of hair. What was the thing we used to use?
Spray net.
Aquanet.
Oh, Aquanet.
Remember Aquanet? And used to spray that in your hair.
Just
and
to get it
oh,
to
you
do
could
all
go,
that?
You can go through a wind tunnel. It would not move.
But it's I know you still perform, but you put on your
I put on
your
the hairpiece.
Yeah,
my mother always, why do you tell everybody you wear a hairpiece? I said, who cares?
Right.
Who really cares?
Right.
You know.
Well, let's talk about your mother. And I know this was a painful part of your book. It certainly was painful to read about the way she treated you, if I can put it that way, and whatever her problems were. And what do you think they were?
Well, I think back then, of course, nobody knew about it, but my mom was definitely bipolar. I mean, everybody thought my mother was the sweetest person to ever walk the face of the earth. But behind closed doors, she became a completely different person. She was evil.
She was evil.
I mean, my daughter, Jennifer, she was in a play, you know, high school, you know, and she had the lead song, and she was wonderful. I mean, she was really, really good. She had nice pipes. You know, she was about 10, 11 years old, you know, not even high school, grade school, you know, they put the play, whatever. And she came home. She was so proud of me, too. And she said in the house, "I sing just like my daddy." And my mother said, "You'll never be what your father was."
Wow.
"Your father was making money when he was 10 years old." My God.
And this was to your daughter, her granddaughter.
Her granddaughter, 10, 11 years old. Give me a break. You know.
So what kind of effect, I mean, as you described, I mean, when you were little, she threw you across the room.
Oh, yeah.
Dinner time was just, it sounded like a minor nightmare.
Oh, yeah. I remember sitting at the table, and this is when, God rest her soul, Camille was alive.
This is your first wife.
My first wife, Camille. Yeah. She passed away in 2003, like you mentioned, of breast cancer. And my grandmother and my grandfather had passed away, and I loved my grandmother used to call me Chickadee. "How's my Chickadee?" You know. So I'm sitting at the table, and Camille cooked exactly like my grandmother because she's, you know, she was behind my grandmother all the time. So we were eating, you know, some kind of, I think it was escarole. In Italian, we call it escarole, you know, escarole and beans. And my mother turned to me and she said, "You never loved your grandmother." Well, the soup came out of my mouth, and I jumped up, and I started choking my mother.
Wow.
And Camille came over and took me off of her.
Right.
She was bipolar. I mean, she could be sweet, but on the other side, you just couldn't deal with her.
And yet you lived with her.
Yes.
I mean, when you moved out of the city, you moved your parents and your grandparents for a while.
When we moved, you know, to the suburbs, when we moved to the main line, my mother went ballistic because my mother was a proverbial shopper. In South Philadelphia, she got out of the house, opened the door, got the 11th Street car, and went into town to shop. Now we're in Penn Valley.
Yeah.
"What did you do to me? You put me on a cross." And I thought I was doing something wonderful for my mom, my dad, and my grandparents. My grandparents loved Penn Valley. They used to say to my mother, "What do you got to South Philadelphia? Look how nice. You got the trees. You got the birds that sing." You know, 3 years. 3 years it took. "Where are we going to get your clothes pressed? Where are we going to get the meats?" You know, she thought we were in Jabip, for crying out loud, you know. And I went into the hospital. I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown because I really thought I did something wonderful for my parents and my grandparents.
But one thing that she also did after your father died was she sort of...
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Intimated that you were her husband? Did I read that right?
My father's nickname was Ott, because there was a famous baseball player by the name of Mel Ott. And my dad played a little bit of ball, so his nickname was Ott. And there were times where, you know, she would look at me and she would say, "Ott." I said, "Mom, Dad passed away. You know, I'm Bobby. I'm Bobby. I'm not your husband. I'm not Ott." Yeah. And you know, after a while, she started losing it. You know.
Was that hard to write about, though, in this book?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But like you said earlier, Marty, I wanted the book, you know, to be brutally honest, very sincere. And, you know, that's the type of person that I am. And I told Alan, if we're going to do this, you know, we got to do it right. There's got to be, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly in this book, you know. And It's brutally honest. It really is.
Well, let me move on to another hit song that you had.
Okay.
Interestingly, you never had a number one hit song, but you had a bunch of number two hit songs.
A lot of number twos.
Yeah.
Like in Cashbox and Billboard, which were, you know, the record rating magazines at the time, it was always two. But different radio stations across the country, you know, Volati went to one, Wild One went to one, so on and so forth. But never in the major papers.
Interesting. Well, this is a song called Wild One. Do you want to set that up for us?
Wild One was my very first million seller, and we were going, when I say we, Dave Apple, who did most of the arrangements for on all of my records, we're going to do the Dick Clark Saturday Night Beach Nut Show, if you remember that one, Marty. And Dave always had a pipe in his mouth, always carried his guitar. And on the way to New York City to do the Dick Clark show, Saturday Night Show, he starts singing. He said, "When we get back to Philly, Bobby, this is your next record." He started with the pipe in his mouth.
Yeah.
And we go back home and we record Wild One.
Let's give it a listen. That was my conversation with former teen idol Bobby Rydell about his biography, Bobby Rydell, Teen Idol on the Rocks. He was joined by the book's co-author, Alan Slutsky. And that does it for the memoir edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Elizabeth Fiedler, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.